This podcast is brought to you by Formkeep, form endpoints for designers and developers. No iframes, JavaScript embeds, or CSS overrides. Try out our sandbox mode before you buy at formkeep.com.
Talk into the mic. I know you're going to want to look at Sean, but don't talk to Sean.
No, it's okay. He doesn't want to look at me. He looks at me too much. Anyway.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, Raphael.
Hi.
Today, we're joined by Raphael Franca. You are on the Rails core team?
Yes, I'm on the Rails core team for the last four years, I think.
And you've made like a handful of commits in that time?
Yes, I think I'm the first one contributors right now.
Yeah, I think you're ahead of Aaron by like almost 1,000 at this point.
Maybe I'm not looking on that website anymore now that I passed Aaron.
Well, now that you're number one, it's, yeah. So we recently had a transition in the team, and Sprockets lost its main contributor, and you were giving a talk today about, or yesterday.
Yeah, yesterday.
You gave a talk yesterday. Not that the timing of the talk matters to the listeners, but you gave a talk about how Sprockets works.
Yes, exactly. My idea about this talk was to give people more understanding about Sprockets and how it works, because since we lost the main contributor, we are now trying to understand how Sprockets works so we can actually improve it and, I don't know, create new features.
We don't know either.
Yeah, we don't know either. Exactly that. So in the last 1 year, I spent a lot of time working with Sprockets. I just made a big upgrade in Shopify from Sprockets 2 to Sprockets 3. And I got to learn a lot about how Sprockets works and how difficult it is for our developers at Shopify to understand how Sprockets works. So I tried to, in this talk, explain how it works and how we can use and extend it in the right way.
So for people who don't know, Sprockets is what provides, it's in your gem file, in your Rails application gem file. If you don't know what it is, it is what provides the asset pipeline behaviors.
Yes, exactly that. Right. It's not in gem file. It's actually a dependency of the Rails gem. But yeah, you got that when you install the Rails framework.
Okay. So what's like the most surprising thing you learned about the state of Sprockets when you took it over?
Okay, so I think the most surprising thing was how it actually works right now in applications. So by default, Sprockets should not compile your assets in productions, but I saw a lot of problems in Shopify because it was actually compiling assets in production in runtime, and that took a lot of time and nobody knew about that. So to fix that, we in the Sprockets Rails gem version 3, we disable Sprockets environment entirely, so you cannot even compile assets by mistake in production anymore. And doing that, I found that a lot of people were doing compilation in production, and that was a really huge break change because I had to fix a lot of bugs because of that. So
there was a bug in that, like, even if you didn't mean to be doing production asset compilation, you sometimes were.
Yes,
so
exactly.
You fix that by disabling the ability to do that at all.
Exactly.
And then a whole bunch of other people said, I was doing that on purpose, and now I can't? Or
not purpose, but okay. The application break, and they don't know why. So
right.
I had to explain that, okay, you were actually compiling assets in production, and now I disable that so you can actually know that you are not compiling. So if you want, you can enable. If you don't want, you have to fix your code.
I think it might have been in Sprockets Rails and not in Sprockets itself, but one of the versions changed it so that even in development mode, the stuff gets digested now, right?
Yes.
Is that true? So now you can't make that mistake where you say, like, I want an image tag, or you don't use the image tag helper. You just use, like, img src equals assets slash, you know, logo.png. And that works fine in development because you weren't fingerprinting assets in development. I guess maybe you probably... I don't know if you could still make that mistake, but...
You can in certain cases, because there are some things that don't get digested unless they're, like, explicitly in a manifest, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. An asset path still returns the string by default if it doesn't find the path that you give it?
Yes, exactly. But, okay. Yeah, all the assets are now digested, so you cannot opt out that behavior, even in development. So you cannot make this mistake of actually... Right. Having your application working in development, but not in production.
Right.
Why don't we just change asset path so if it doesn't find the file, it raises an exception instead of just returning the string you gave it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the reason is sometimes you really want to use assets that are not in your application, like external application or external dependencies.
Right, but then you just use the string and don't call asset path.
Yeah, that's true.
Seems like there is an easy worker.
Yeah,
there.
Yes, exactly.
It just returns the string unchanged.
Yes, we can try to change that. I don't know, maybe some people is using that behavior, but it's actually one of the most surprising behavior we have in asset path is exactly that. When you don't have the asset, we fall back for the public folder. And some people don't know that that happened because it's not documented at all. So it's surprising. I actually had this problem yesterday when I was working my talk. I tried to reproduce exception that we give now in development when you don't precompile the asset. And I could not because I actually enter in this behavior of if you don't have the asset, it tries to fall back to the public folder. So even me had made this mistake. Right. Of not knowing this behavior.
Yeah. I mean, it's a common mistake. I think everybody runs into it at least once. And, right, it's always, anything that involves not getting an error in development mode but having it blow up in production is always tricky to spot. And even for us as API designers, it's difficult to realize sometimes when that sort of mistake is being made, like in that we're introducing an API that makes that even possible. Because we're you know, when we're actually testing a lot of stuff, we're usually testing it in development mode.
Yes.
The other change, like that I was super excited to see was at some point along the way, Sprockets lost the ability or the default ability. I don't know if you had to opt in. I think you just couldn't do it anymore. When you precompiled the assets to also generate them gzipped. And I think the idea behind that originally was like, well, you're web server can do this for you automatically. Like you can just have the gzip plugin and it can gzip for you or something like that. But the advantage of having the asset pipeline do it as part of pre-compilation is that it can do the slow version of that and like eke out every little bit that it can get. And then your server doesn't have that overhead at all. Right. So I'm excited to see that coming back. Do you know what the more about the specifics of why that was removed and what the challenges were there?
So if I remember correctly, it was a bug in Apache. So to actually serve the assets, Apache were doing the etag calculation. And for some reason, the etag calculation was not correct for the gzip version. So to fix that, Josh just said, the previous maintainer said, okay, you can have the web server doing this for you and you not have to have the same etag bug, so you can just remove from Sprockets. But in Nginx, it's totally fine to use the Sprockets version and it actually works in the correct way. So we put back, and also there are some platforms like Heroku and CDNs that if we actually have the gzip version is better for them, so
yeah,
it's coming back now.
Also, source maps. Very excited for source maps.
Yeah, I'm excited too, but there are still some bugs that we need to fix before the final version of Sprockets 4. It's more like we know how to calculate source map for CoffeeScript files, for SSS files, but normal CSS files and JavaScript files, we don't know how to calculate that yet. Richard and I were working to get that ready for the Sprockets 4, but I'm more focused on Rails 5 right now, so.
Yeah. After it was announced on stage that we're shipping this week.
Yeah, exactly. I have to ship today or tomorrow.
Yeah.
Before the end of the RailsConf.
I'm doing the upgrading to Rails 5 workshop tomorrow, so if you could drop the release candidate like an hour before, that'd be great, because then, you know.
How about we drop it an hour into it?
An hour into it would be even better. It was like, what? What?
Yeah.
A minute ago, we weren't getting this failure.
We can just have somebody in a suit come and slip you a piece of paper.
This is Rails 5.
Rails 5 has been released, RC1 has been released. Ideally, the release candidate is identical to the final release.
Right. Well, we've seen processes before that go like Rails 4. I think had several release candidates.
I think
we had two. Yeah.
Yeah. True.
Okay. So it happens sometimes.
Yeah.
But that's exciting. How has that process been for like who owns the process of deciding like we're good, we're gonna do release candidate now?
The release manager.
Okay.
And yeah, right now the release manager is Sean in the lean, but sometimes me and Jeremy took off the release manage process just because they were too busy to do the release manage process. And we have done this for, I don't know, 4 years, 3 years. So we know how to do that. Yeah. But the main problem where we have a lot of new features in Rails 4, 5 actually, and we tried to implement some difficult stuff like auto-loading in development, being thread safe. And
easy problem to solve.
Yeah, that is exactly what is blocking the release right now.
That one's actually fixed.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So now we only need to release Rec 2, I think.
That is the main blocker. There's one other really small one that I can just fix as soon as Rec is out.
Okay, so by the time people hear this,
Release candidate will certainly be out,
and hopefully the actual final build will also be out.
Yeah, no, the final build will be out by the time this goes out.
All right, so cool. And we'll all be upgraded to Rails 5, and we'll be on our way to 5.0.1.
Yeah. No, but it was funny, like, because we've been saying that we're going to ship this week. Like, that was the plan.
Mm-hmm.
Before this week, that was definitely the plan, just because we got a room rented out, and we're all here, and we can make it happen. But we weren't expecting David and Jeremy to both announce it on stage, because, you know, like, now it's like, hey, no pressure, guys.
Well, I don't know. If it didn't happen, I don't think anybody would like leave disappointed. If it doesn't happen this week, it'll happen next week.
I would leave disappointed.
Well, sure, you would be. You might be feeling the added pressure of having that announced, but I don't think it changed anybody's expectations.
Probably not.
Materially. Like,
yeah, probably people is not even ready to upgrade to Rails 5.
Right.
Half of them aren't even on 4.2 yet.
Right. The people who want to upgrade to Rails 5 want other people to do it first. So like
they're gonna let
other people go first and see how it goes anyway. And
like your workshop.
Yeah, we'll do it in the workshop. That's right, as long as we have Wi-Fi.
Well, and if you don't have Wi-Fi, right, we'll have like half the Rails core team there, so we'll just rewrite Rails 5 offline right there.
Right.
No problem.
Sure. Sounds good.
So Sprockets has a release cycle that is independent of Rails, right?
Right.
So when Sprockets 4 comes out, is it just going to be everybody changes their gem file and we're all good? Or is it going to have to, how's that going to work?
Yeah, that is something that we need to figure it out, because Sprockets is not a direct dependency of Rails, and most applications don't have the Sprockets version defined. So if you is going to upgrade your Rails gen, you are going to also get the newest Sprockets that in the case will be Sprockets 4. And that for sure will break a lot of applications. So I don't know how to fix that yet. Maybe we should put Sprockets as explicit dependency in the application's gen file.
Yeah, and then we can just put an upper version limit on the hard dependency in our gem spec and then stop having it as a hard dependency at all.
Yes, we can try that.
Cool.
So
problem solved.
Yeah, it is.
Problem solved live on the bike shed. So what else is coming in Sprockets 4? Is there anything that people aren't like that isn't super well known?
So apart of source maps, we have some new processors like the SAS C version. So you can actually have better CSS, faster CSS processing using the C implementation of the SAS project.
Oh, so it uses libsass?
Yeah, libsass.
That's awesome. I'm very much excited by that.
Yeah, so no more timeouts when you change your CSS files.
Yes.
Yes, that's really great. And also we have some... Sprockets had a lot of internal changes. And now the API is more stable. We have a good API for extending Sprockets. So it's easier for, like I presented in my talk, to create new processors, to create transformation between different MIME types like SVGs to PNGs. Or I think it's also possible to create, I never tried that, but it should be possible to create image sprites using Sprockets built-in, because you can actually have a bundle processor that just merge all the images and can also generate the CSS classes for these images.
Seems like it would be good.
Yeah, that sounds awesome, because I've done spriting before. I used to use Compass to do spriting because it had something built in for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't use Compass anymore, and I just stopped spriting things because spriting things is a pain in the ass.
Yeah, well, and it's like with HTTP2, it stops being
true.
Helpful.
Yeah.
True, but we'll be waiting for that
right.
for a little while anyway.
Well, then you showed...
What's going to come first? Broad availability of HTTP2 or like source maps? It's a race.
No, well, then is the Babel processor new in 4 or is that new in 3?
Yeah, it's new in 4.
Yeah.
2.
So we ship ES 2015 compatible stuff by default?
Yes, exactly. By default. Not by default in Rails application, but it's built in Sprockets. So it's just easy as you change the extension of your JavaScript files to ES6. So you can have new JavaScript implementation by default in any Rails application.
And then you were showing a way to use a directive to get dependencies from NPM.
Yes, I did.
So you can get left padding in your strings very easily.
Exactly. I never thought about that. I should have made this joke.
You should have.
Yeah. So you'll be able to use... So I want to make sure I get this right. So you'll be able to use a directive in your manifest file?
Yes.
To say, get these dependencies for me from NPM?
Yes, exactly that.
That's pretty awesome.
Going to install the dependencies, but if you have a project, NPM project inside your Rails project, you can just call NPM install, and that is going to be installed on the node modules folder, and that directive gets the right version of your asset from NPM.
So do you have to do, at that point, would you have to check those NPM modules into your project for deployment purposes?
No, you just...
No, you can just install...
Well, actually, yes, because shrink wrap still doesn't work.
Right.
Oh, yeah. And you want reproducible builds.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly
But still,
that.
That's nice, because like, I've been preaching to use Rails assets for a while for asset dependencies in Rails, and that's going away.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
I believe. I mean, at one point they announced it was going away. I'm going to pull it up on my phone right now, see what's going on. But
yeah, I think it's really cool. Like, I don't think a lot of people have ever considered what Sprockets does. I think there's a lot of hubbub about just, like, why doesn't Rails integrate with Grunt or Gulp? But Sprockets actually does a lot for you and is much simpler.
Yes, I agree with that. It's the reason that we actually believe that for Rails, it's better to improve Sprockets and get in the same level that the other alternatives are, like Webpack and I forgot the another one.
Broccoli, Grunt, Brunch.
Browserify. Browserify, yeah.
And I mean, if your main goal is just to concatenate and... minify your CSS files, like everything can do that. There's really no reason to use one tool for just that over another. And sure, like some of the other build tools can do really, really cool stuff if you're doing really complicated things, but you could also just not do complicated things in your JavaScript builds because you're concatenating and minifying files.
I wonder, like, I agree that at this point, I don't think there's any reason to like pull out the whole asset pipeline and be like, now we're doing an NPM-based thing for your front-end stuff. But do you think if you were inventing an asset pipeline today, right, would you write something like Sprockets, or would you do, like, the comparison I would draw is like to Elixir. So Elixir had, or Phoenix in particular, had like the decision to make about whether or not they were going to build an asset pipeline or just use NPM. And so they decided, well, we're just going to use NPM. This is more established at this point. But
I think I would more closely integrate things that operate with ES6 require over the require directive. But beyond that, I don't know.
Yeah, I also think that I actually participated of the decision of what they were going to do with the Phoenix asset pipeline. So I were in the platform tech at the time, and I talked with Jose about the problems of Sprockets and the integration with Rails application. And yeah, we agreed that it would be better to Phoenix to try other alternatives before actually having decided to build the whole thing. So I don't know how it's going right now. Maybe they are a red set that they want to keep using Branch, but maybe in the future they may need some features that they would have to implement in Elixir itself.
Well, in theory, they could use Sprockets in Elixir, right?
Yes, but exactly. I talked with Jose and I gave that alternative, but he said he did not want to introduce Ruby dependency in Elixir's.
But introducing a node dependency is fine.
Yeah, exactly. But actually, because even in Sprockets, you actually need a JavaScript environment, so you would have to have the Ruby environment in the JavaScript environment to use the Sprockets.
Yeah, and I mean, like, because I think everything except Linux has one by default, but Windows Script Host is only ES3 compatible, and that means that can't work with any version of the CoffeeScript compiler later than 6, which I still need to fix that. Not fix like Windows Script Host, but basically the fact that the gem file that we generate fails on Windows unless they have Node installed. And it's just because the CoffeeScript compiler uses object.create, so we can just polyfill object.create when we load the CoffeeScript compiler.
Yeah.
Or generate an older version.
Of CoffeeScript.
But like that, the problem isn't going to go away. And so I feel like if we just lock it to an older version, eventually that does become
a problem.
Yeah. And it's just, I think it's just easier to polyfill object.create for them when we load that file. I had a patch. I just needed to figure out the right place to put it and then forgot about it until right now.
But given that now in Windows you can develop in Bash, do we still need to fix these problems? Because it's a Ubuntu Linux installation, right?
Right, but I do still want it to, like, I'm not so much concerned about developers using Windows at their day job. I'm more concerned about programs like RailsBridge. And so I want the thing that a brand new person is most likely to do to be the thing that just works.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so anything that involves and install Linux, even if the because the install process for Bash on Windows is pretty okay, but it's definitely targeted at like
developers.
Whereas the one-click Ruby installer is more familiar to people who aren't developers. But you know, it's little things like having it not error.
Yeah,
and it's great because like it was so hard to track down because the error message you get is undefined is not an object with no stack trace. From Ruby code.
Yeah, that's a problem with ESXjs. It's hard to see, have the stack trace.
Yeah. No, it was just fun. Like, it was, it took almost a full day to figure out where it was coming from. And finally, we realized, but it was the CoffeeScript compiler. But I had no inkling that it was the asset pipeline in the first place, other than that it was a JavaScript error message. But I was just trying to figure out, like, because there were no JavaScript files, right? But we still run application.js through the CoffeeScript compiler.
Yes, we do.
So it's it's just trying to compile an empty file. But I just remember thinking, why am I seeing a JavaScript error in my Ruby code? This makes no sense to me. Anyway, it's all tricky. I wish there was a lib CoffeeScript.
Yeah, I wish too. But given that the JavaScript community prefers to write everything JavaScript, that would never happen.
No. Yeah.
Is CoffeeScript going to remain the default for the foreseeable future?
Yes, David still wants CoffeeScript to be the default. Although I believe that that may cause some problem because CoffeeScript and ECMAScript 6 have the same construction like classes, and they are not compatible at all. So if you have a project with both CoffeeScript and ECMAScript 6, you are going to have problems. In Shopify, we are migrating all the CoffeeScript files to JavaScript files again to use ECMAScript 6.
Yeah, for most of my projects, I haven't even been using ES6. Like, I just write JavaScript ES5, I guess you would say. And it's fine. Like, it's not great, but, like, it works when I'm in my happy place of almost everything is server-side code, and then I sprinkle on a little JavaScript, and that works just fine. If I were doing, you know, a front-end app, then I'd probably do ES6, but
yeah,
because there's some nice stuff there. But
I don't know. I think we do need to have an easy config option that just changes all the generators to ES6.
Yeah, that's really easy to do, actually, because what we can do, for example, is have ES6 by default in Rails, the framework itself, because right now it's JavaScript, right?
Mm-hmm.
And have the CoffeeScript gen to actually change the generator to generate CoffeeScript. This actually works right now.
Right.
So if you don't have the CoffeeScript CoffeeRails gen in your gen file, you are going to get the JavaScript version, not the Coffee version.
Right, and so then we just, if they have Babel Rails but not Coffee Rails, then we generate .es6 by default.
Or we can just not have any chain and have ES6 by default in Rails, but if you want CoffeeScript, you actually...
Oh, I see. So you're saying we just fall back to Babel and not ever fall back to normal JS.
Yes, exactly.
I think that's fine. Maybe.
Who wants normal JS?
I mean, the downside is we effectively enforce a node dependency on Rails.
Is it
Babel is written in Node.
Oh.
Yeah, but we also have the Babel chain. RubyGen that does the same thing that CoffeeScriptGen does, that is running through the ExactJS runtime, so you don't actually need Node.js.
Does that actually work, though? Because I thought Babel needed Node specifically.
Yeah, they need in the version, I don't know, it's 4, maybe 3, I don't remember the version, but we can actually generate installation of a node and get all the JavaScript files and put inside the chain.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool.
It's kind of what we are doing in the Sprockets CommonJS project that we have at Shopify that actually gets some small JavaScript modules and put inside the chain.
Hmm. I mean, this sounds like a giant hack, but...
Yeah, it is a hack.
But hey, it works. No, that's good, because that's just, I don't want to introduce Node as a hard dependency of Rails, because especially, again, right, going back to the newbie use case, like, that's just a really confusing thing. Like, I need to install Node to install my Ruby?
Yeah, that's really confusing.
Especially because all of this, we also just need to have it not use any of this on a brand new project. Like, if application.js is empty, have it not... Other than including jQuery and jQuery.js, have it not run it through any compilers? Because that's actually the bigger problem, is like, if they need Node when they start doing JavaScript stuff, that makes a little bit more sense. But when it's just you do Rails new and your server crashes unless you have Node.
Yeah, that makes sense. We need to check that, because yeah. it should be that way.
I wonder if it's just a matter of having jQuery.js be written in JavaScript, at least in the version that actually goes onto RubyGems.
It's actually written in JavaScript.
Oh, I really wonder where the... we should look at, when we have a chance, we should look at where the CoffeeScript compiler is getting invoked, because something is invoking it.
Maybe it's TurboLinx or Maple Action Cable.
Oh, it probably is TurboLinx.
Yeah, TurboLinx use CoffeeScript.
Yeah, TurboLinx should just ship. Like, again, regardless of whether it's written in CoffeeScript, the gem should ship the compiled JavaScript.
Yeah, we did that with Action Cable. And I think TurboLinks 5 is also in JavaScript.
Okay, well, then maybe the problem just goes away, and I'm worrying for nothing. We should check this, though.
Cool. Yeah, I'd like to see the TurboLinks dependency on CoffeeScript go away. So if I know that wasn't the case in the old version, so if 5 does it, that's awesome.
Yeah. For all the people using TurboLinks, they'll be very happy.
I think there are a lot more people using TurboLinks than you probably think.
I don't know. We've done our polls.
Okay. We've done our poll. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
We're biased.
Do we use TurboLinks? Yeah, we use TurboLinks 3 at Shopify, don't we?
Yes. Actually, we made another implementation called TurboGraph.
Okay.
It's similar to TurboLinks, but...
But graph-based?
No, it's more because it has support to partial replacement, right. I believe. And right. TurboLinks don't have.
Well, that was TurboLinks 3.
Yeah. Which never saw the light of day. But,
right.
Yeah, exactly.
GitHub is now doing something.
It's totally different.
It's different?
Yeah.
I just noticed the progress bar now is at the top of the screen, and I was like, that looks like TurboLinks.
But I think it's something like the PGX.
Right, which is similar.
Yeah.
Yeah. That idea is similar.
Yeah.
There just needs to be a browser API for showing like progress in the native browser UI.
That'd be awesome, because it is really confusing when you switch between a GET request and a POST request.
Yeah.
And the GET request shows you in viewport progress, and the POST request shows you browser UI progress.
Well, it's like, and everybody is doing some form of in DOM replacement now. Like YouTube has their special loading bar now too.
The problem with exposing that to developers is that developers are going to get it wrong, and they'll be never ending spinners, and you'll be like, is it doing something? I don't know what's happening.
I mean, but they can still just do that.
But that's part of page UI, not browser UI, right? So you know that, like, I guess there's really no difference.
I don't think the average user knows or cares.
It's true. All right. I'm on board.
Anybody on the Chrome or Firefox teams listening? Get on it. I don't know. That need to be that'd need to be a TC39 proposal, I guess, because that'd be a JavaScript API.
Yes.
Can we just make it? Like, there must be a process for somebody outside to come in with a proposal. We should just propose this.
Okay, we'll work on that. Me and you, we'll do
it. And then we'll have TurboLinks. Just work with it, and then nobody will have any reason to complain about TurboLinks. And
you don't need to build
bars.
Your own progress bar.
Yeah,
sounds good.
I actually don't care if people are using TurboLinks. I just care if they complain.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you're sort of in a similar boat, right? Where you focus a lot on maintenance and not on features.
Yes, I use it to work on features, but I think there are a lot of great people doing that already, and no one wants to maintain software because it's way more boring than implementing new features. So I try to be more useful to the team and do the things they don't want to do.
So how do you feel about Action Cable?
Yeah, it's a new feature that, okay, it's looks great. The implementation is way better than it was.
Yeah, that is true.
When it dropped in the Rails repository. But it's not something that I'm seeing me using a lot. So for me, created more overload of things that I don't use that I have to maintain. That's fine because we are a team and...
Yeah, sure.
Actually, that also happens when I push some kind of features in Active Record that people don't use, but I use. So, yeah. It's created more things to maintain, but it's totally fine. It's something that we really need to do because we have to evolve the framework in some way.
Yeah. I just, you know, my whole thing is that I don't think it should be... Default.
Yeah.
Same with TurboLinks, actually. I think it's actually more okay for Action Cable to be default than TurboLinks, because TurboLinks has gotchas.
Right.
Like, TurboLinks isn't just something that you can drop in and ignore and be unaffected by it. Whereas Action Cable, like, at the end of the day, if it's in your gem file and you're not using it, it doesn't really affect anything other than maybe...
Dependencies.
Yeah, and I think we probably generate some JavaScript by default, too, but...
Yes, we do.
But even the dependency story has been cleaned up quite a bit. So.
Yeah, that one has. Because I want to eliminate the C compiler requirement entirely for Rails. And we're almost there. I don't remember what's left. But there's still something. Oh, Nokogiri.
That's hard.
That is very hard, yeah. And I'm not sure if we can...
What in the default stack uses Nokogiri?
HTML sanitizer.
Yes. The sanitizers and also the assertions, it has to have some kind of HTML parser, so it's using.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if we can provide a fallback, or maybe the sanitizers get turned on when you like flip a gem on. Just some way that when you do gem install Rails, by default, it will work without a C compiler. because that makes the getting started story for newbies so much better. Because especially like on Windows, you have the one-click Ruby installer, and that's all fine. But then installing what they call DevKit, which basically is just a MinGW stack that includes like Windows-compatible GCC and whatnot, has a really, really confusing install process that I got wrong like twice. Because you wouldn't expect it. It's a Ruby script you run. But when you're doing this because Ruby isn't working properly, it's not a thing that you'd expect to do Ruby some file, and the file's not named like setup.rb. I don't remember what it is. I don't know. It's a really confusing thing. And in theory, like everything that a C extension does for Rails, especially given that we support JRuby, anything that's done with a C extension should basically always just be a performance improvement over something that has a pure Ruby fallback.
Yes, that makes sense. Maybe we can get... I don't know why Nokogiri don't have a fallback. Maybe because they use the libxml library default. But I know they have a Java fallback, so maybe they should have a Ruby fallback too.
Yeah. I mean, implementing all of libxml is no small task, but yeah. It'd be worthwhile. Like,
I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm sure there'd be no bugs in
Ruby. Alternatives in poor Ruby, right?
Yeah, we do. The problem is Lufa doesn't use them, and none are similar in API to Nokogiri. Yes. So it's non-trivial to port to something else. I remember Mike Perham was looking at into this recently, specifically looking at if we could remove Nokogiri as a transitive dependency for Rails. And he came to the conclusion, not that it was impossible, but that it was a bigger task than we might want to do.
Yeah, it's something that I want to work is to get more support to different sanitizers. Right now, we use only Lufa, that depends on Nokogiri.
Mm-hmm.
But there are different sanitizers, like there is a sanitizer Gen that is also great, and the API is compatible with Lufa. And it also uses Nokogiri, but we can actually build a different sanitizer that don't use Nokogiri at all.
Yeah. This is a regex.
Yeah, and in and also in Shopify, we still use the deprecated sanitizer because we have some different...
Because we're special.
Yeah, requirements. We're always... We have different requirements for sanitization.
Right.
And the new sanitizer is breaking something, so I just fall back for the deprecated sanitizer. But... if we need to keep that in Shopify, I would have to not deprecate that sanitizer anymore. So maybe I need to get some kind of API to switch between sanitizers.
Welcome to the deprecated sanitizer core team.
Yeah.
All right, we should probably wrap up so we can get to the next round of talks. Do you have anything you want to plug or anything like that before we go?
Anything that you're excited about?
Yeah, so I'm excited about two things. The one thing is the IBM Virtual Machine being integrated with Ruby. I don't know if you saw that project, but there are some people in IBM working to get the core VM doing some things that works do Ruby do right now, like garbage collector and memory. Things like that, and for me it's something that is interesting to see better support to battle-proof VMs in the Ruby MRI Ruby interpreter. So
yeah, we'll get Koichi to get on it.
Yeah, that's really great. And yeah, also the Koichi talked today about how to generate bytecode from Ruby code was really great, and it's something that I think we really need in the Ruby interpreters. It's something that would maybe change some the whole story about Ruby being slow.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll put a link to that talk in the show notes. Thanks for coming on, Rafael. It's great having you.
It's great to be here. I'm a listener of the podcast. So
long time listener, first time caller.
Yeah, it will be fun to listen to me in the podcast.
Great.
Cool.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/67.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes and Google Play are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about this episode or any others, you can tweet us @_bikeshed, email us at host@bikeshed.fm, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.